Doherty Show, 97.5 The Fanatic. All right, so there's some tweets from an hour ago from John Heyman, who is the insider MLB Network, FAN 660, Score in Chicago, et cetera, et cetera, right? In the Major League Baseball proposed scale, minimum salary players will get greater than 100% of the prorated pay, but close to it. Star players will take a big hit. Stars can make up some, assuming that the postseason is played, but it's estimated stars will still take about a 50% additional hit, more by one accounting. Major League Baseball goals to start spring training June 10th, so the soft deadline for a deal has been said to be June 1st, but that's probably soft. Personally speaking, I mean, I know it sounds ridiculous because the longer that it goes, the fewer games that there will likely be. There is no deadline. Like, I believe in my heart of hearts that Major League Baseball will play a 90-game season or an 80-game season or a 70-game. Like, I don't think that there's a deadline for getting anything done. Like, what's the smallest number of games that Major League Baseball you think would play? Like, I believe that there might not be necessarily a regular season. You might just do a bracket. Like, if you're running out of time, like, if you're completely out.
Yeah, I don't know if they'll get that far.
To me,
the minimum they'd play is 50.
Okay.
And the reason that I say 50 is because 50 gives you, in theory, you would get at least one series with every team in your division, right? You could do a four-game series with the other four teams in your division. That gives you 16. You could probably do two. Let's say you did two and you got the 32, and then you could play the other 18 games of, like, let's say for the Phillies, you could play three against the Pirates, three against basically the entire AL East, you know, and that gives you your 18. So you're keeping proximity as best you can,
right,
and still playing 50 games. I mean, that formula kind of worked, and I was putting it, you could see my brain churning as I was putting it together as we were speaking.
Not bad on the fly.
But that kind of works in proximity for these teams. They keep it localized. The Phillies don't leave the East Coast. The farthest west they go is Pittsburgh and Atlanta.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's not too bad. And Toronto, I guess, but that would be the way to go, I would think.
All right. Okay. We asked a question before the break that is kind of central to this whole thing, the Kelly Green. And I don't know if you know, maybe we're wrongly attributing motive, which is something that I try never to do. Like, we can't just assume that people feel a certain way because, you know, they feel a certain way. The Kelly Green stuff. I have talked about why I'm not a big fan because it is from a team that never won anything, that didn't put Randall in position to win, like all that other kind of stuff, right? But is it possible that it just looks better than the Midnight Green to some people? I know that you said that Kelly Green's an eyesore, but is it relevant, like, what the teams did during these time periods for the jerseys to have, like, meaning or be interesting?
Partially, yes. Okay. I think so. I think there are probably people that just compare the two colors of the jerseys and say, I prefer Kelly Green to Midnight Green. Whereas I go the other way. I think the Midnight Green's a little bit sleeker. It looks a little bit nicer on the football field. That's just me. And probably partially the reason being is the closer that colors get to each other, especially when there are two jerseys involved, I have a hard time differentiating them.
Okay.
So for me, the Midnight Green is easier to differentiate from the opposing team's white jersey than the Kelly Green is.
Okay.
I know they're not, Kelly Green's not white, obviously, but it's a little closer because it's brighter.
Right. It's so, not dark. It's
right.
Not dark
so
versus
that,
light.
That to me is one.
Okay.
I also think that, like I mentioned earlier, there are people whose formative years were the Buddy Ryan years. You know, the guys, the Reggie Whites, the Jerome Browns, Seth Joiners, all these guys that were, you know, the maulers of their defense, and rightfully so. I mean, the defense was unreal for eight straight seasons or whatever it was.
Sure, of course.
So I get that that's kind of their formative look on things. I just associate that particular era, especially not having lived through it, as an era of underperformance and underachieving.
All right, so let's talk about something that I speculate might happen in Seattle, right? I would anticipate that at some point, because, you know, you saw it happen with the Los Angeles Rams, right? I would anticipate that at some point you're going to see the Seahawks go back to like the teal and silver kind of look, like the, what people would now consider the retro look. I would anticipate that the Seahawks will go back to like that silver and blue at some point with the teal accents. I think that they look okay, but I really like the like neon kind of lime green touches that the modern Seahawks have incorporated. Now, some people don't. I don't mean like the all green, but I think that it's the Russell Wilson era is a good look for Seahawks jerseys as far as I'm concerned. That matters more to me than the fact that that was the Richard Sherman, Russell Wilson era where Super Bowls were won and Malcolm Brown was the Super Bowl MVP. Like, I think that that doesn't matter to me as much. However, I'm not a Seattle Seahawks fan. So I don't know. Like, I look at some of the uglier jerseys that were from, you know, ancient history effectively in the NHL or in the NFL rather. Does it matter that teams are winning championships during those, or does it matter more that fashion's come a long way and the experts at Nike and Adidas and Reebok have come a long way in terms of their jersey designs? I do think that that's relevant.
I certainly think so too, but I go back to the one in particular that I go back to that people always bring up, but every time it gets brought up, it's brought up in a joking fashion. It's like, haha, remember these?
Right.
It's the creamsicle Tampa Bay Buccaneers jerseys.
Yes.
When they started, would they lose 26 games in a row to start their franchise?
Right.
That is, I mean, that jersey, that color scheme is marred in a pathetic start to a franchise. I mean, the worst we've ever seen. The Houston Texans, their first year when David Carr was on his butt every play, were way better than that Tampa Bay team.
Well, I think that that's definitely true. But the other side of that, Tyler, is that you've got teams like Tampa Bay, like Jacksonville, like these teams that have never really had glory years. I know that Tampa Bay did win a Super Bowl, but like even the Tom Coughlin teams that, you know, were making their runs in the postseason, you're seeing these teams try to reinvent jerseys with gradients and huge numbers and like all this other kind of stuff. There's also, you know, doing too much that we've seen. There's also like trying to forge a new path that just doesn't work. Now, Karate Mark gets to the heart of this thing, and this is a big problem with being an Eagles fan. Says, in my opinion, the jersey off the field and outside of your heart is all about fashion. Kelly green, silver and white, super dope. Midnight green, very meh. But the problem is, not many kicks to match up the jersey with either. Hashtag boring. That's true. It's not easy to find midnight green accented shoes to wear. Probably easier to find silver or something for Kelly green.
Totally understood. Now, see, I'm the kind of person where I will do everything I can to match up until the shoes.
Okay.
So like, shoes are not an accessory to me that are part of my outfit. Now, to a lot of people, it's a huge part of their outfit.
Mm-hmm.
To me, they are just necessary because my feet are not evolved to walk on concrete and rocks and grass.
Okay. Got it. My color evolution, I learned about complementary colors very late in life, like what complementary colors were. And I'm not going to wear red and green, except if it's Christmas. A color scheme that I wear very, very often because they are complementary colors, and I learned about that, like I said, way too late in life, is blue and orange. I wear blue and orange all the time because they make each other pop. Therefore, it's like four straight pairs of shoes that I've bought that have some kind of orange in them. It's a problem that I have. It's like, it's, I won't even be looking for it on like whatever the Dick's like shoe display. Just can't help it. So to me, Karate Market does matter. You're absolutely right. Mike and K&P is next on the Fanatic. What's up, Mike?
Hey, how you guys doing today?
Doing okay. How are you?
I'm doing all right.
Good.
I hate this. Like, whenever someone brings up Kelly Green, mm-hmm. it makes me sick. That color looks awful. It looks slow. It looks old. When they brought it back and Mike Vick wore it, it looked atrocious. It just looks terrible. It looks out of place and out of time.
Mm-hmm.
And the only, I'll give you the stereotype of somebody who wants it back. Some 50-year-old dude still driving a 1985 IROC Camaro that he had when he was in high school, listening to Glory Days on repeat with his high school football jacket in the back seat. That's the person that's wistful for the Kelly Green jersey.
So it's a living in the past kind of thing.
Basically. Like, I mean, it represents the worst era of football for the Eagles ever. I mean, Midnight Green looked bad at first, but they tweaked it, and now it looks good. And it represents a winning culture where we've done really well with it. Kelly Green is, you've lost so many games, you never made the playoffs except every once in a while, and you never won a Super Bowl. Just let it die. It's dumb.
So would you, Mike, that question begs, would if they had to do a different jersey or they were going to do an alternate or something like that, is it? Would you rather it be something new that you hadn't seen before, or would you rather it just be from a different era of
you? You know, I like when they rock the black jersey. Like, uh-huh. The black jersey looks good. Like, you know, like that gray that they have to run out for that Kelly Green just looks god-awful. It looks like you're running a 5.4 40 with the receivers.
Mike, thanks for the phone call, man. I appreciate it. Yeah, I know that it was, even when Vic wore it, not a terribly popular look. Like, I saw one person tweet out a picture, was like, wow, these things are fire. And there were a bunch of people that were like, wow, they are really not. They are really, really not good. For me, it's probably not so much they look god-awful and slow. I think the biggest reason why I'm not a big fan of them is because of the results of the teams. I think I can't separate it.
Well, I would normally say that is fair. However, the one that I will kind of counteract that with is the maroon pinstripe Phillies jerseys. They did win a World Series with them, but if you gave me the option between the maroon pinstripe and the red pinstripe, I'd take the red pinstripe every day of the week. I think they're cleaner. I think they're a little crisper. The pinstripes are a little smaller. I just like that color, that red color, a little bit better than the maroon color. I don't know. And maybe because both won, like both variations of a jersey won a Super Bowl, uh-huh. A World Series. But I don't know. I don't value the maroon nearly as much as of a winning culture as say if Kelly Green were to have won a Super Bowl.
This all started with the question, what is something in Philly sports that most people in the city love, but you don't? 610-632-0975. Also, we are discussing the return to play proposal for the NHL. Obviously, more and more teams are starting to, more and more leagues are starting to come out and talk about their plans. Major League Baseball has been very vocal. You've seen the NFL kind of, as we anticipated they would be, full speed ahead until we're not, right? Gary Bettman reiterated, by the way, that for next season, which is the 2020 and 2021 season, it could start as late as December, if not the start of January, if necessary, would still try to play a full season. Yeah, they're not trying to have like two truncated seasons. That's not really happening. Wow. This is from Jesse Rogers, who covers the Major League Baseball and the Cubs for ESPN. According to sources, under the Major League Baseball proposal to players, a player making $35 million in 2020 would make about $7.8 million. A player making $10 million would get about $2.9 million, and a player making $1 million would get $434,000. That is a large percentage haircut for those making the most.
So it's a 60% pay cut for the low pay guys?
Right.
And then you're upwards of, what, four-fifths? You're at like an 80% pay cut for like the guys like Bryce Harper and Manny Machado?
Yep.
That is a steep price to pay.
That is a large, large haircut. So I don't know how that would work. I don't think that it would. The other thing that I don't know is how many players in Major League Baseball are making at least that much money. So, let's see the highest paid players. Because this will give us a good indicator. of how many players would be taking that sizable of a pay cut. Not saying that it's great for anyone, but the highest paid players in 2020, you got Mike Trout at 37.7, Garrett Cole at 36, Max Scherzer at just under 36, Greinke's at 35, Strasburg's at 35. Arenado's at 35, Verlander's at 33, so that, like, that's the group that you've got there. All right.
Looking down that same list you are?
Yeah.
Is there one name that might stand out to you above the rest?
One name that stands out to me above
not in a good
the
way.
Rest? Oh, of all the guys who are making all that money? Yeah, that's a lot of money for Greinke.
No, that's not who I was anticipating.
You didn't think so?
Thinking? David Price making $32 million.
Oh, I didn't look that far.
A little bit further down the list.
Oh, no.
And now I know it's split between the Red Sox and the Dodgers, but not only is the guy making $32 million, but the Red Sox were able to get somebody to take half of that contract.
That's great.
That's incredible.
The rest of the Kershaw deal is not great either, but, you know, that's okay. You're paying for Kershaw. But, yes, I'm not a massive fan of the Greinke contract either. That was a perfect time to get out, even though he had a really good year last year. I think that overall the contract's been like kind of yikes.
Well, and a lot of times when you get those guys, you are overpaying for the namesake.
Of course.
The Phillies probably overpaid a little bit for Bryce Harper.
Probably.
The Padres probably overpaid for Manny Machado.
Yep.
Just simply because money would dictate, you know, like this amount of production equals this amount of money. I don't know if any amount of production equals $35 million
right,
from a professional baseball player.
What can you do?
But
exactly.
You're going to overpay for these guys because you are... you're refilling the money when it comes to revenue in seat purchases, in jersey purchases. You're going to make a lot of that money back.
Maybe 100% Ohtani. Maybe that's the one.
Just you because know. He plays multiple positions?
Yeah.
He can do both.
Starting pitcher and probably your best hitter.
Well, and the problem is, too, I don't know if he's going to pitch again this year.
I don't know if he's going to pitch again, period.
He may never pitch again.
Yeah, that might be done. 610-632-0975 is your phone number. Top aboard the conversation. Why do you think everything's coming out now? Why, do you think it's like the weather getting nicer? Do you think that it's having Memorial Day weekend to think about it and talk it over and stuff like that? Like, what is it? Why is all this coming out about the NHL, Major League Baseball, the NBA? You heard Troy Vincent talking over the weekend, the NFL. Why is all of this coming out right now? Is it just because of the positive news with respect to, you know, the coronavirus?
I think it's a combination of a couple of things. I think that helps. I think the way that things are trending, it looks good for right now. I think that also, too, a lot of these teams or a lot of these leagues, the other three leagues specifically, when we're talking about the NFL and everybody else, the NFL has maintain that they're going to play and they're going to play just as normal.
Right.
All of these leagues are going to do what they can to not necessarily be first, but definitely make it back before the NFL starts.
Oh, yeah.
That's like priority number one, because the NFL is already king to begin with. If the NFL gets back, does an entire offseason, and gets back before the rest of these leagues start, there's going to be a loss of interest. There's going to be a questioning of the... of authorities up top, meaning, you know, commissioners and deputy commissioners and owners and things like that.
Sure.
I think that a lot of these leagues are doing everything they possibly can to generate their revenue again and also get ahead of the NFL.
Well, I believe this too, that it's not just the pro sports leagues. The college teams have to be kind of careful about this, about how you handle it either way. Like, one, are you willing to put student athletes at greater risk than other students if you deem that there's a risk great enough that students don't have to return to campus, but you're trying to get college sports back again? That's a dangerous road to walk.
Sure.
Either way. The other thing is, you know, with all of these sports potentially being delayed, if the NHL gets pushed back, if Major League Baseball gets pushed back, if the NBA gets pushed back, if they're going up against the NFL in September, October, November, college sports are going to have no chance, period. Like, how would you like to be college early season college basketball or like even mid to late season college football trying to play catch up in this environment? It's not going to work. It'll work in like Tuscaloosa and Clemson and places where like college sports are way bigger than pro sports, but nationwide ESPN coverage and stuff like, seriously. And I love people hate ESPN all the time. I don't. You tell me what's going to happen. Are they going to talk about the Maui Invitational in college sports? Or are they going to talk about LeBron James in the playoffs? Are they going to talk about Tom Brady in Tampa Bay? You tell me. You tell me where you would allocate resources if you were in charge of one of those networks.
Well, and I know, too, that a lot of these cities, a lot of the big, you know, metropolitan cities, some of them, like Philadelphia, has Villanova, big-time college basketball program. But when you look at college football specifically, how many big cities have a big college football program attached to them? Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. I mean, Pittsburgh's got Pitt, but that's not that big anymore. Philadelphia and Pittsburgh kind of claim Penn State. But it's not a Penn State town. New York has Syracuse, I guess, would be the biggest school, or Army. Neither of them are going to draw the college football interest. Mm-hmm. Miami, for what Miami Hurricane football used to be, probably more so is going to be attached to seeing, A, what Tua can do, and B, the Miami Heat.
Right.
I don't know.
Chicago, I'm trying to think. Like
LA doesn't care about anything.
Right.
You know, so like, there's no city, in my opinion, that's going to have no big metro city that's going to have a care of the college ranks more so than the professional if they get caught up in this.
So if you're one of those and the professional sports leagues are reopening, what's your course of action? Like, how do you handle it?
Well, I guess you have one of two options. Your option is proceed as normal,
right,
and hope for the best, or you don't play.
You bag it. Well, there's already been issues, clear executional issues, philosophical issues. There have already been problems with the spring seasons getting canceled effectively, and how teams and colleges and schools are managing scholarships, student aid, like all that other kind of stuff. That's a whole nother group of people. If you're incorporating fall and winter potentially into that, that's danger zone here. And I think I saw UConn is in trouble with this already. With canceling, I think that they have already canceled football. Did I see that right?
They've canceled the season entirely?
I think they dropped down. So, according to media reports, the University of Connecticut is laying the groundwork to eliminate, this is on SI.com, to eliminate multiple sports next month. They've got a daunting balance sheet due to COVID-19. The athletic department specifically has been hemorrhaging money for years, running a deficit in excess of $40 million last year. They might be dropping 8 sports, going from 24 to the NCAA Division I FBS minimum of 16. Now, a 24-team department's larger than most, but whacking a third of it would rival one of the biggest bloodlettings in collegiate sports history. So there you go. So it was multiple sports. Obviously, football wouldn't be one that would go, I don't think. But we've seen that happen before. 610-632-0975 is your phone number to join the conversation. They're going independent at the moment. Look out. Joe Torti Show, we're hanging out until 10 o'clock right here on 97.5 The Fanatic.
97.5 The Fanatic.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top 5 Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
97.5 The Fanatic.
Welcome back. Joe Torti Show, 97.5 The Fanatic. We're together until 10 o'clock. Looking at the reopening plans, of course. The NHL is the one who has the most clear, crystalline return to play, as it was announced by Gary Bettman today. I'm confident that due to the magic of radio production, we will have that press conference ready for you at some point for the show, in case you missed it earlier today. Flyers make the playoffs. The regular season is done. They clinched a playoff return for the Flyers, and the Flyers are in probably the best shape of any of the teams that are in the Stanley Cup playoff field, certainly in the Eastern Conference. I'll tell you about why in a second. 7 o'clock hours brought to you by Club Risqué, the Delaware Valley's premier gentlemen's club with three locations, Philly, Bristol, and Northeast Philadelphia. For more information, visit clubrisqué.com. The Flyers are in the fourth seed, or the fourth spot in the Eastern Conference currently in terms of total points. The top four teams are going to do a round robin to determine seeding. This is so that you're not running into a team that has had time to warm up in a best-of-five series, and you're facing that team cold. Of course, after, like, you know, months and months of layoffs. Or of a layoff of months and months, I should have said. But the Flyers now with the opportunity to get to the top seed in the Eastern Conference. If they're able to navigate this round robin section of the playoffs, really, really good for the Flyers. Incredibly good deal this is. If you're the Boston Bruins, quite frankly, I can't believe that you voted yes on this. To be completely honest, Boston must be very confident in their ability to just win it out on the ice if they are even considering voting for this. There were two teams, Tampa Bay, who is the second team, and Carolina did not vote yes on this. The reason's unclear, obviously. There's still more that's going to come up here, and more details are going to emerge. But that is the latest. It has been adopted by the NHL, and the timeline for that is kind of up in the air. It'll be fluid, and reportedly it'll be science and medicine that advise the timelines for this. Then, of course, Major League Baseball. You've got pay cuts proposed by Major League Baseball for the highest paid players. That will not go all that well. Vince McMahon said that in bankruptcy court that he's not going to attempt to buy back the XFL. Was, you know, staving off allegations there that was his plan was to get the league back at a discount. And then Mark Cuban suggested a play-in tournament for the final two seeds in the NBA playoffs. If you didn't hear this, Cuban considers it a must for all 30 teams to participate in the resumption of the NBA season. Currently planned to take place at Walt Disney World in Orlando because of the financial impact of fulfilling local television contracts. In Cuban's proposal, the top 10 teams for each conference would qualify for the postseason and be reseeded based on record. There would be two play-in matchups, either single games or best-of-three series. It would be the 17th seed against the 20th seed and 18 versus 19. The winners would advance to play 15 and 16. Then the playoffs would proceed with a best-of-seven. All but two teams, Minnesota and Golden State, would have a mathematical possibility of qualifying for the postseason under his proposal. The Cavs and the Hawks are four. They're at the bottom of the Eastern Conference standings. They are four games behind the Charlotte Hornets for 10th place. Cuban said it's fair, it's entertaining. He acknowledges that it would be challenging to schedule all of the games required to make his proposal work, but it's the plan that would best address the league's financial issues and desire for competitive fairness, as well as allowing playoff teams to ramp up for the postseason, hopefully limiting injuries after a long layoff, which, of course, is the issue. I also hate this idea. Ty, what did you hear about the groups idea?
Kind of like the way that FIFA does it?
Yeah,
like the World Cup type deal? Yeah.
I agree with Cuban in that this is a garbage idea. He said the reason he doesn't like it is because it throws away the value of the entire season, where two teams emerged from each group. Could not agree with Mark Cuban anymore here.
Well, and that's particularly correct, because when you look at the World Cup, even though all of the teams qualified for said World Cup, there is, in most groups, I would say, not every group, because there always is the group of death, right? But in most groups in the World Cup, there are two extremely, extremely top-notch teams that you're like, these two are probably going to advance.
These are the advancing teams.
There is one that you go, okay, if things break right, maybe you get a break, you win a game you're not supposed to, or someone loses a game they're not supposed to, maybe you get in. There's always one team that's like, yeah, okay, likelihood that Trinidad and Tobago is getting in is pretty low.
Participation trophy.
Right. In the NBA, if you were to do said round-robin FIFA-style tournament, the comparison between the best team, who is either the Bucks, the Lakers, the Clippers, and the worst team now, who is the Golden State Warriors,
right,
is too close. Even with the Atlanta Hawks, is much closer than the comparison between, let's take Spain or Germany, and like we said, Trinidad and Tobago. Right. Let's say they make the World Cup.
Right.
That is a much larger gap than it would be for the Bucks and the Hawks.
Yeah, I think so too. I think the gap in talent there is dramatic. And not only that, you look at the World Cup, if you are one of those lower tier teams, qualifying for the World Cup is the thing. Like that is like what you're there for. Yeah, you'd like to win, but your season's already successful in that you qualified for the World Cup. Or not even season. Your last couple of years have been successful because you qualified for the World Cup. That's not so much in the NBA. At least I hope not. Are there NBA teams that are like, yay, made the playoffs as an 8 seed?
Yeah, probably the New York Knicks.
Yeah, maybe.
Charlotte Hornets, too.
Be stoked to make the playoffs and just get stomped. 610-632-0975 is your phone number to join the conversation. On Twitter, it's at Joe Torti and at 97.5, The Fanatic. Paul Arch tweets in regarding things that everybody in Philly loves except you. I don't get the love for Buddy Ryan. Do you think that is because Philadelphia has prided itself for a long time now on being a defense-first, hard-nosed, hard-hitting kind of deal? It's been like that with the Sixers. It was like that with the Flyers, obviously. Been like that with the Eagles. Do you think that's why that like Buddy Ryan is kind of a personification of that? Because, Paul, that's what I think it is. I think that it's a guy that lines up with what the city values the most in its sports teams. I think that's...
Yeah, I think that's probably pretty fair. It's just, again, it goes back to nothing was accomplished. I mean, there were years and years and years. I get it. Between 1960 and 1980, the team was garbage. And effectively from 1980 to 89, 90, they weren't very good either. So I get that for a lot of Philadelphia fans, that was the beacon of hope for Philadelphia Eagles football. And maybe it's because people that are around my age and around your age are spoiled with the fact that the Eagles have won... what, 8 division titles or 7 division titles since 2000 alone? I don't know. I look at that Buddy Ryan era and just kind of go, eh, it was good.
Right.
It wasn't great.
It was an era.
Yeah, it happened. Yeah. Didn't win anything.
I'm with you.
You know, it would be one thing for a team that lacked a single Super Bowl for 52 years if they would have made one. Right, because then you could say, okay, they made it in 80, they made it in 91, and then they did it in 2004. Like, at least there's something there to cling on to.
Yeah.
For a team that won one playoff game, I can't do it.
Hard to get on board with that train. 610-632-0975. Coming up, I want to share this with you. Audio that, perhaps... suggest that Michael Jordan wasn't completely forthcoming in The Last Dance. I have to share this with you when we return. It is the Joe Torti Show. Tyler Zuli is producing. We're hanging out together until 10 o'clock. We do have wide open phone lines if you want to join the conversation. We'll also hear from Gary Bettman in a little while as well. It is the Joe Torti Show, 97.5 The Fanatic.
97.5 The Fanatic.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
97.5 The Fanatic.
Welcome back. Joe Torti Show, 97.5 The Fanatic. We're together until 10 o'clock. Tyler Zuli is producing this evening's program. And Tyler, we discovered this earlier today. I mean, through our investigative work, which is to say that, you know, it popped across our Twitter timelines. Apparently, our friend Michael Jordan was not 100% truthful during the Last Dance part where he squashed the whole Isaiah Thomas Dream Team beef. Now, the problem is the audio sounds like it was recorded on a potato. So forgive us for not playing you the audio and assaulting your earballs with it. But Tyler has deciphered it. And you can relay for the people what basically the message is.
So basically the message comes down to was Michael Jordan saying he will not play for the Dream Team if Isaiah Thomas is on the roster. That's really what it boils down to.
Literally.
That's it.
It's the whole thing.
I mean, it's incredible now that we have The Last Dance and 10 hours of documentary to go through. We all kind of had a feeling this was the case. But now that it comes to life in this audio recording, I just don't know how to feel about it. I feel kind of weird.
Really?
I do. I don't know which way to kind of take this.
Well, so here's the thing. I think that it's probably, for a guy like Michael Jordan, probably doesn't regret a ton in his life. I would assume. I would assume that he's a guy who doesn't like to have regrets generally. But to show that Isaiah Thomas got to him at one point in his life is probably not the most comfortable, comforting memory for Michael Jordan. That's what I'm anticipating, or I'm thinking that this is. I don't know for sure. Obviously, context for this is not clear. But the first thing that I thought of, what a lot of people are bringing up now that they've heard the clip and that they've seen it and that they've listened to it, is what would an actual out-of-house, non-Michael Jordan-sponsored documentary look like? You know, like what would the... Because The Last Dance captivated people. What would, you know, what else was Jordanized in this documentary?
Well, and that's a great point because I don't know about you, but I left after watching 10 episodes and going, okay, Jordan did a pretty good job. If he was, you know, EP or... assistant producer, or whatever it might be, right? Whatever his role actually was. He did a pretty good job, I think, of telling both sides of the story, for the most part. Now I'm interested.
Right.
Now I want to know if there's anything else that was kept under wraps, that he tweaked a little bit, that he made Jordan sound better / Isaiah Thomas sound worse. I'm interested. We might need more.
Well, and here's the thing about it, too, is that it's possible that, like, Jordan regrets it because he had a change of heart in that knowing that the Olympics is not something that everyone has an unlimited number of chances to do. And if he was involved in single-handedly keeping Isaiah Thomas off the Dream Team, regardless of what was going on at the time, it's possible that now he has a different feeling about it and has the context of, like, you know, Isaiah Thomas is never going to get another chance to play, you know, potentially on an Olympic team, and certainly not that team, which is, you know, it put basketball on the map for a good percentage of the world.
Well, and 4 years is a long time for a normal person.
Yeah.
Four years for your profession is a long time.
Yeah.
4 years as a professional athlete, I mean, could be legitimately the difference between working and not working.
Right. Yeah, literally. So that's a pretty shocking revelation. Not that it necessarily, you know, quote unquote, matters, but it does make me wonder what else did not make the documentary, let's say, or was left on the cutting room floor. 610-632-0975, your phone number to join the conversation. On Twitter, it's at Joe Torti, at 97.5, The Fanatic. I do wonder what contingencies are in place here. Adam Silver talked about this, I think, last week or 2 weeks ago, that said, where he said, someone's going to test positive. Like, something's going to happen wrong during a reopening plan. And if one positive test is going to effectively sink us, then we shouldn't be talking about reopening. I do wonder what the NHL's official protocols are going to be, given that they're going to be ramping up testing as the phases go on. Does that mean that they're trying to keep a house of cards effectively intact? Or is it that they're going to continue and remove whoever is, you know, testing positive and whoever they've contacted with? Because how could you do it? It's like the entire team, effectively, you're in contact with. I don't know what it means. Like, what the increased testing volume means.
Right, and that's kind of my big concern about this whole thing. You use the house of cards, you know, metaphor to get at that. I think that's a pretty good one. I'm trying to, like, figure out, like, what kind of, you know, what kind of substance could you build a house out of that if you remove a brick or remove cinder or remove plywood or something, that it would almost like epoxy into each other and be, you know, and stay steady.
Right.
I just don't know if unless the groundwork has been laid so well, you know, to continue with the metaphors, that this can be sustainable.
Right. Yeah.
But then on the only other alternative, if that's the case for me, is you don't play, and none of us want that either.
Well,
I'm just so concerned about what's the best option. The NHL seems to be laying out that best option for us, for the NHL players. The Disney World option makes it better, but I just don't know if it's just like a pluck and continue on. You know, like, this guy tested positive, pull him out, pull anybody that's roommates with him out, and then just move on.
Right.
I'm so conflicted.
All right, so here's... Nobody wants to say this. I will. I don't care. In this instance, is the NHL evaluating with the players, does it only matter if you get sick? Like, is that what they're going to end up looking at? Like, if everyone's going to be in these hub cities and you're not going to be near, quote-unquote, traditionally at-risk populations, understanding there have been outliers that have come up over the last several weeks... If someone tests positive, are you going to be monitored to see if you get sick, if your condition worsens? And if not, then you're still full speed ahead? I have no idea. Like, I have no idea what the actual plan is for something like that. That's why I'm asking.
Right. You would think that that's kind of how it sounds.
It's a non-zero possibility.
Right. Because, yeah, you know, when you think about it, there have been, of the cases, how many percentage have had, you know, no symptoms?
More than
not. Right. Have been asymptomatic, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know if... That's going to be just the intention is, okay, if you test positive, we pull you out, and then we just kind of see what happens.
Right.
You know, if you test positive and your roommate tests positive and neither of you show symptoms and neither of you get sick...
Should you have to sit out 2 weeks?
Right. I don't know the answer to that. My answer is yes.
Right.
My answer is yes, but I don't know what the league is thinking.
Right. I don't know, and I'm sure... As things get closer to reopen, the good news is for the NHL and for Major League Baseball and for the NBA that the start of play is still kind of nebulous, right? Like, it's still kind of far off, foggy in the future. They don't really have to answer those questions yet. Like, they're just kind of putting together a groundwork, effectively, for how this thing happens. But then when you start putting dates on things, these are the questions that are going to end up being relevant. Like, these are the questions that are going to determine whether the whole plan falls apart or if it's something that you could actually do. I mean, given that there's limited information about the course of the virus and everything else, I don't know how comfortable I am with an idea that, like, hey, if you're not sick, just go ahead. Like, does that mean you're going to have to get waivers from everybody that they're playing against that you're cool with this person? Like, there's just a lot of questions. There's a lot of questions that end up being obstacles, I would think, to something like this. Speaking of obstacles, the more and more I look at this, there's no way, like, if you were a Major League Baseball player, there's no way that you should accept this arrangement. Like, I don't know if there's, like, negotiating still. But looking at it, if you make $30 million, you're making less than $7 million. I get it. By the way, it seems more drastic. Because, like, you're talking about a prorated rate. These numbers are a little bit deceptive, right, Tyler? Like, so I would think if you're making $30 million for this season, if there's half of the games, you're not making $30 million, you're making $15 million.
You would think.
And your $15 yes. million gets cut to 6.95. So I would think that these numbers are a little deceptive as we're reading them now, because that's assuming $35 million for 162 games, and that you're now getting paid $7.84 million for 162 games. I don't know if that's even on the, like, what's being discussed here. I don't even know if that's what's on the table. And that's something that we didn't mention before.
Right.
That, you know, is potentially relevant to the conversation.
I got
to
tell you, I don't know, you know, we've been doing a lot of shows together lately. You've heard me say it 100 times probably by now. I didn't think that the MLB was going to play to begin with.
Yes.
I think I'm almost doubling down on that at this point.
If this is the deal,
if this is take it or leave it for Major League Baseball, there will be no baseball this summer.
Yeah.
Because these guys are not going to agree to that.
That's a terrible deal. It's a terrible deal.
And I understand that, it comes down to safety versus getting your money, right? That's kind of what it seems like. And now you're almost putting the players into a spot where it's neither.
Right.
Right? Because you would play and with playing jeopardize safety, and they get a prorated salary because they're only playing 50, 60, 70 games. I don't know if there's any way that these players can agree to this.
610-632-0975. I think you're right, Tyler. I think Major League Baseball, I would argue, now is in greater jeopardy than the rest because of this thing. It is the Joe Torti Show, 97.5 The Fanatic.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.